Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. I'm reporting from Kansas City, Missouri today from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Annual Convention. This convention brings together the leaders in agriculture news from around the nation, along with newsmakers, to discuss issues and share knowledge of what's going on in our areas. For this special Friday edition of our show, I have interviews for you from the convention. We are at NAFB, and we're talking about farm broadcasting this year, and I'm sitting down with another farm broadcaster. Go ahead and introduce yourself to us. Tell us where you're from and what your name is.
Right. My name is Brent Adams, and I am the host of Tractors and Troubadours, which is a production of Rural Strong Media, which is a startup media company based out of Cape Girardeau, Missouri. I actually live in southern Indiana, right across the river from Louisville, Kentucky. So anybody familiar with the National Farm Machinery Show, that's our backyard here. We're getting ready for our Super Bowl here coming up here in a couple months. But, you know, our mission is really to tell the story of agriculture. We go to all these farm shows and conferences and conventions, and the common refrain we hear all the time is we got to do a better job of telling the story of agriculture. So that is why we exist. You know, we bring in agriculture industry newsmakers, hot button industry issues, and educational features. And also we had an element of traditional country music in there. So through that, we bring in a separate audience, which is consumers, you know. And so we not only try to educate ag practitioners, but we also try to educate the public on what we do. And, you know, part of where that came from, I had a really good conversation here a few years ago with Orion Samuelson. I mean, anybody, you know, who knows anything about ag broadcasting, I mean, he's just the dean of ag broadcasting. And, you know, I grew up watching how he operated. And, you know, being on WGN, he wasn't just talking to farmers and ranchers. He was talking to, you know, the average consumer, you know, to the people in the suburbs, to housewives, to everybody. He was trying to take, you know, something that could be somewhat complex and distill it down to make people understand why they should care about. And all that has been laid bare through the pandemic, you know, especially the first time you showed up at the grocery store and, you know, either you couldn't find, you know, what you were looking for because of supply chain issues, or, you know, now today we see bacon at $7 or $8 a pound. And you know, people kind of, well, first of all, they get mad at the supermarket. They think it's the supermarket's fault. And then they kind of want to go back to the producer and think maybe somehow the producer's getting fat and happy on that. So, you know, we look at it from the producer's standpoint, and you look at all the input costs, everything that's going into it, and these guys are scrambling to try to, you know, mitigate risk and manage costs. So how do you, you know, convey that to them? That's why, you know, you're looking at, and then you've got the, you know, the other interests in there that are getting their cut. You have to break it down, because I think, you know, people look at the, you know, the nightly news or just mainstream media, and they like to share kind of the gloom and doom without giving a lot of context. So I think our value is to really dig deep and get granular and share that context with people. So that is a huge part of what we do when we go to these. You know, we want to be objective about it, and we don't sugarcoat the challenges in the industry. And, you know, even when those challenges are within the industry, you know, we point those out. And but we don't want to fixate on the negative either. You know, we want to accentuate the positives. And I think a lot of those get lost in the mainstream media. There's a lot of positives in agriculture right now. I mean, we're trying to feed the world, you know, and that's a huge job. And week in and week out, we just try to get a hold of all the cogs in the wheel, and we try to show how all of this is connected. And it's a fun job. It's really exciting to get to come and do this every day.
I agree, and I really like what you said about educating consumers. I broadcast primarily in California, and so even though California is a huge ag state, it's also a very crowded state. We have a lot of cities and a lot of people who are very disconnected from agriculture and have no idea where their food or fuel or clothes or a multitude of other things actually comes from. So I see it too as part of our job is to help them learn true facts about agriculture, because like you said, mainstream media also doesn't always get it correct. Sometimes, and sometimes through no fault of theirs, sometimes they're just as uneducated as the consumer is. So I find that in my position too, I'm often educating other media professionals too. You First off, I love the name of your show. And you, it sounds like an awful lot of fun. Can we talk about some of the fun that you have?
Right. So part of this is I spent some time doing public relations in the music industry and worked with some independent artists out of Nashville. And I'm kind of a country music traditionalist, so I like a lot of the old stuff. And I'm talking about from the big bang of country music in Bristol, Tennessee in 1927 on down to maybe about the 80s or early 90s, you know, maybe that era. And, you know, there are certain things I like about this era in small spots. But for the most part, the traditional artists and what's happening in Nashville and in Texas, another hotbed, there's a lot of great artists that are going unknown that had they been around 20 years ago or so, they would have been as big as George Strait or, you know, Alan Jackson or somebody like that. But today they're being overlooked. And I just saw so much great talent. I was like, man, there's got to be a way to create a conduit to get that music out to a wider audience and even sneak it into the back door of terrestrial radio. And we've been able to do that with this show here. You know, I have a segment called Back to the Country, where each week we feature a different, primarily traditional country music artist that's, you know, trying to make a name. And we've had some great names on there. We've had Dylan Carmichael, who's kind of blowing up right now. He's the nephew of John Michael Montgomery and Eddie Montgomery of Montgomery Gentry fame, and been on the Grand Ole Opry and a new single out with John Party. And, you know, so we've had him on there recently. And Cody Wickline. We've had a lot of people from The Voice and American Idol and so forth. And I know everybody's kind of familiar lately with Alex Miller, who's, was open for Brett Young at the FFA convention coming up. So people like that. Erin Enderlin, who has become a great songwriter. Her album Faulkner County was probably one of the biggest albums of, 2019, early 2020. And got a lot of great songwriting credits with so many greats in the industry, like Jeannie Seeley and Rhonda Vincent, you know, and she had a number one with Rhonda Vincent, and another buddy of mine, Bobby Tomberlin, who also wrote One More Day for Diamond Rio, and big songwriter. And so it's fun when you start it. Country music industry is a lot like the ag industry in that it really is kind of a small family. Once you start connecting the dots, there's not many degrees of separation. So as I started peeling back some of those layers and making connections, it led to some really fascinating conversations and connections and opened up some really cool doors. And talk about Jeannie Seeley. I did a great, I had a kind of shift. Before the pandemic, I was doing a lot of recording at the Ernest Tubb Record Shop in Nashville is where we did it. And they changed hands during the pandemic, and we wound up going to a different route, and we needed a new partner, and the George Jones came on board. So they've got a great gastropub and museum honoring George Jones and so forth. So we're going to be recording some live segments there. My co-host on that is going to be John Paycheck, who's the son of the late Johnny Paycheck, another icon in country music. And it's just been so much fun. But, you know, during the pandemic, I kind of had to shift, and we weren't able to go do these in person, so I had to start doing live streaming. Well, I was doing a ton of traveling in 2019. I knew in the back of my mind I needed to get into live streaming. Just didn't have the time. But, you know, kind of about April 2020, I kind of got a kick in the pants. It's like, you got to start doing this here to start getting this stuff. So started doing those, and those went off great guns. One of the favorite ones I did was Jeannie Seeley. Who's still doing, at 80 years old, still doing the Opry like three times a week, and is just between kind of the reigning queen of country music. And we had a great time. I surprised her with Bobby Tomberlin and Dallas Wayne of SiriusXM fame, and we just had a great time talking shop. And also Tim Atwood was on the program for 34 years. He was the piano player for the Grand Ole Opry, and now he's got a great solo career. So, you know, just involving people like that. And, you know, one of the greatest compliments to me is the fact that they have been so engaged in what we're doing and so giving of their time. And I always love when I can find these artists too that have agricultural ties. I always look for those first and foremost. We have a guy out of Kentucky by the name of Rye Davis who's starting to take off, and Rye's a farmer. He used to play professional baseball in the Philadelphia Phillies organization, and he's also a farmer down the Bowling Green, Kentucky area. And so Pig, Kentucky, of all places, Pig, Kentucky is where he's from. And they've got a cattle farm there in Pig. And, you know, so I always look for ties like that. And there's so many of them. And so whenever I find those, we kind of lead into the conversation by talking about, you know, how farming and agriculture kind of shape their values and how they see the world and their work ethic and the whole nine yards. And then we kind of ease into songwriting, and you know, we get into pretty deep into the inside baseball of the recording industry and the songwriting industry and stuff like that, and just hope some people find some value in that. And then we share some of their music and give people a taste of it, and just another way to kind of make that tie and create a conduit to take some of that great music into rural America, because a lot of it has kind of disappeared from the terrestrial radio airwaves and in you know, place of something that kind of sounds like 90s pop music. But you know, it is what it is, and not knocking that. Obviously people are buying it, so they keep producing it. But you know, for us traditionalists, you know, and I know there's a lot of them that spend a lot of time in the tractors and combines and in the shops, and like to listen to that good stuff. And yeah, you know, I was here, country music's dead. No, it's not dead, you just have nowhere to look for it, you know. And and so we're trying to create that avenue to get those artists out there, and there's a ton of them. And you know, over the course of the last 2.5 years, I've done, I don't know, probably close to 120 different artists now, and exposed some of that music. So we'll keep on pushing forward with that.
All right. So for our listeners out in California who now, of course, want to hear this and want to tune in and hear the Ag News and also your, you know, the country music ties, can they find you online?
Right, so we are just in the process of launching a brand new website, which is going to be called ruralstrongmedia.com. Again, ruralstrongmedia.com. And my show, Tractors and Troubadours, is going to be available wherever you get your podcasts. So primarily Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Deezer, Audible, Odyssey, and YouTube. So all those places to get that content. And yeah, we'd love for you to come and check it out. And California is another market that we are really kind of itching to expand into, and you know, keep an eye on that. We've got great ties with the World Ag Expo, and Jennifer Fox has become a good friend over the years, and have done some stuff with them in the past, and really excited about what's going on out there. That's the beauty of this job, is it? You know, a few weeks ago, I was down in Moultrie, Georgia, at the Sunbelt Ag Expo. We're focusing a lot on peanuts and cotton, and you know, then we can go out to California and look at almonds and the dairy industry. And grapes and so many you know, in produce in the valley. And it's so cool to be able to just share that, you know, not only with folks there in the state, but also tell that story to the rest of the country, you know, that takes for granted when that stuff shows up on the shelf at their supermarket where it's actually coming from and what it takes to get it there.
Yeah, I agree. And I love that the story of California farmers is making it out to other places in the nation as well, because obviously California farming, very important to me. And we in California know how important it is. But so often stories get misconstrued as they spread out into the nation. So it's nice to know that there are farm broadcasters like you out there telling the real story of our farmers. So thank you, and thank you for your time. I know it's a busy day. It's a busy day here for all of us here at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual convention being held in Kansas City, Missouri. I appreciate your time.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you so much for all that you do. And it's an honor just to be here and talking with you about all this stuff, and we wish you the best of luck with it. And any way that we can help you guys get the message out, we are front and center to do that.
All right. Thank you very much, Brent.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Your name and your title, please.
Yeah, John Latham. I'm the president of Latham High Tech Seeds and past chair of American Seed Trade Association.
So we've had quite the interesting year or so, and there are new developments that have really helped some people get through this. Let's talk about technology.
Yeah, it was a crazy year. You know, we started off, we were able to plant early, and there's a lot of frost early on, and then we got into some drought conditions in a lot of areas, and it just really variable weather we saw in a lot of different states. And one of the things that I've heard from a lot of farmers is it was a lot better than I thought it was going to be at the end of the results at harvest. So to me, that goes back to some of the investments the seed industry is making in genetics and technology and seed treatments, gene editing, you know, making seed better all the time. And I, you know, one of the things I also heard is, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, this would have been a complete disaster. And we're able to get through diseases and drought so much better than we could before. And that's thanks to the investment of the seed industry and farmers obviously investing in seed also.
You know, I know this is a saying somewhere, but it all starts with the seed, right? So
right.
when we want to invest in our agriculture, we want to make sure that our agriculture not only feeds us today, but feeds us for generations. Creating new technologies for seeds for new challenges that we're facing becomes very important. So how does that work?
Yeah, well, we're doing a lot of different new things with gene editing, especially. And in the past, we were working with technology, biotech technology, and it took a long time to get these biotech traits in and a long approval process all around the world. Now we're really, a lot of companies are shifting into gene editing, and we're able to get some disease resistance, improve the genetics, and even do some of the things that biotech can do, and we can get them a lot sooner, and we can actually get a lot more companies involved in it. So really excited about gene editing, and Asta's taking a lead, not only in the U.S., but worldwide, to educate people about gene editing and how it's going to help feed the world. So we're really, really proud of the work that Asta's done.
You know, and can we talk a little bit along those lines where talking about educating people, and when we talk in the general public, not necessarily in agriculture, but when we talk in the general public about gene editing, there's still a lot of misconceptions out there. If for people who are listening who are not in agriculture, because we do have a lot of just general population listeners, what would you tell them about gene editing?
Yeah, gene editing is something you can do, you know, with traditional breeding, like you can with traditional breeding, but you can do it so much faster. And so it makes you know, the improvements that we've seen in these seeds, you know, move along so much faster. And we don't have to have the worldwide approval process that we've had with biotech, which costs billions of dollars and slows everything down. So yeah, it's a great new technology. It's environmentally safe. You know, we're seeing great results environmentally, which is exciting. So yeah, it's really the next frontier, and it's doing things so much simpler, and we're getting more people involved in it. So I'm really excited about it.
You talked about worldwide approval, and are there still problems or difficulties, let's say, with some countries who maybe don't understand gene editing as much as the U.S. does with getting things approved?
Yeah, and then unfortunately, there's company or countries that use it as a trade war, you know, and they're using it as a bargaining chip instead of really looking at the true science. I mean, the science is pretty clear on it, but a lot of times they'll delay things for years, and then that affects farmers because they can't get the products that they need as quickly as they should.
Not to editorialize, but using food security as a trading tool, it makes things very challenging, especially for farmers in those countries who just need to grow food for their population, right?
Right. We're all looking to help feed the world. The world population continues to grow. The middle class continues to grow in a lot of these developing countries. So it's really important that we get the technology, you know, around the world. And so we've got American Seed Trade does its best and does a great job in fighting some of the misinformation that's out there.
Yeah. And that's that's a good focus for the American Seed Trade Association too. So again, for listeners who want more information, is there information out there that ASCA puts out?
Yeah, I mean, go to our website, betterseed.org, and there's a whole host of information there. And then that'll lead you to other resources, too. There's other websites, too, that they'll fight through some of the misinformation. And then, too, you can follow American Seed Trade, Better Seed, on social media. And we put a lot of great information out there as well.
Any closing thoughts for us today?
No, I'm just really proud of the work the American Seed Trade Association is doing to help feed the world. We've got 700 companies across the U.S. from all the way from alfalfa to zucchini, like we like to say, and we're all kind of working together to help feed the world, no matter which crop, no matter which area you're in. So we're proud of the work American Seed Trade is doing.
Thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Start out, please, with your name and your title.
Ethan Lane, Vice President of Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Well, there has been so much going on just in the livestock industry in general in the last year and a half. Let's start out with a couple of the things that are bills that are working their way through legislation. So what do we have going on there, and what do you expect to happen?
Well, like we always do this time of year in Washington, you know, we're kind of in this rush to get the government funded, and that really dictates the timeline for all of our efforts on any legislation. You know, we don't do single bills anymore in Washington. We haven't for a very long time. So we look at these big ticket packages, whether it's the infrastructure package that we just saw pass a few weeks ago, or this, you know, behemoth social spending bill that we're watching Speaker Pelosi try to navigate through the House this week with very limited support, or the fact that, you know, come December 3rd, we're going to yet again need to deal with debt ceiling and government funding and livestock mandatory reporting reauthorization and a whole host of things that have been put off from back in September. And, you know, that's not unusual, but it does kind of give us a little bit of a timeline of what we can expect as far as actual votes on things. And that's where we're going to continue to focus over the next few months. You know, LMR reauthorization is the must accomplish item in that bucket for the next few months for us in the cattle industry. That ended its five-year authorization last year. It has been writing appropriations bills and being extended since then. While the industry, and it's not just, when I say industry, not just the cattle industry, but it's you know, other proteins as well. A lot of the issues have actually been with some of the other proteins and other non-related stuff that has held up that conversation. We have our own price discovery discussions going on in the cattle industry as well, but we kind of need to be able to do two things at once. We got to make sure that critical transparency tool and information tool for producers doesn't lapse, while we also have a discussion about what we want out of life with LMR for the next 5 years. And those two things are going to have to kind of happen at the same time. We're not going to get that done by December 3rd, right? So we're hopeful, and we think that Chairman Scott agrees with us on this front, as does the ranking member G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania. They want to go ahead and get that extended for a year so we have some cushion to talk about these issues, make sure we have a real discussion about what we want to see as far as changes potentially out of LMR as we move through that process. That's going to be the focus in the next few weeks. We saw a cattle contracts library bill pass out of the House Ag Committee back a few weeks ago on a voice vote. It was introduced on a Tuesday and it passed on a Thursday. If that doesn't tell you that the House Ag Committee feels strongly that that's a point of bipartisan cooperation in the cattle industry right now, nothing will. So we know that's going to move to the Senate. There's going to be some discussion in the Senate on that bill as well. that same language is pretty closely mirrored in Senator Fisher's Cattle Markets Transparency Act and her new compromise legislation with Senator Grassley on price discovery. We're still sort of looking at the details of that. You know, we had a press release, but no bill. Now we kind of have bill text that we're looking at. And it is a departure from where they've been on this issue. Senator Grassley's been pretty, you know, pretty dogmatic about 50% cash trade throughout the country. Senator Fisher's taken a regional approach and said that she recognizes those regional differences in the use of AMAs, you know, in Texas and Kansas versus Iowa and Nebraska, where they trade more cash cattle. This bill is interesting because it takes a different approach. It appears to cap those requirements for cash trade in the Texas and Kansas side. So it puts a requirement on them to increase cash trade, but it lowers the requirement in places like Iowa. So 3 times the lowest producing cash region is the maximum that the highest producing cash region can be capped at. So that would mean that this bill for Senator Grassley caps cash trade in Iowa in the low 30s rather than 50%. So it's a different approach, because what it's really going to do is probably redistribute AMA use more than discourage it. And that's interesting. That's going to be something that we're going to have to watch our state affiliates, because they all have different opinions on this. They all have different policies on this throughout the country, throughout the supply chain. You know, feeders and cow-calf producers look at these issues differently, not just regionally, but, you know. So that's going to be a really interesting discussion for us between now and our convention in Houston to see where we're at. You know, we have people on both sides of this thing. We have Iowa producers that are aggressively in favor of government intervention in the cattle market. We have Texas producers and Idaho producers and California producers and others that say, we don't want the government in our business. And we got everybody in between, right, that kind of like a little bit of it, but maybe not all of it. So that's where we've been for 2 years. This bill notwithstanding, that's still where we are. And we're going to have those conversations over the next few months leading up to Houston.
So with so much that has been going on in the cattle markets and just markets in general, if you were to look into the future, what do you see for the coming year? And I know that that's a hard question. Yeah. I'm putting you on the spot, but you being the expert, what do you think we might see in the coming year?
You know, you hate to see a market improve because of drought and things driving a herd contraction, right? Particularly when our trade footprint is surging, when demand is surging. People want the best beef in the world, and it comes from right here in the United States. Whether it's U.S. consumers, whether it's Japanese consumers, or whether it's the $1 billion in product we've sold to China this year, which was unheard of a few years ago, right? We have to be cognizant of the fact that we are growing our footprint both here and around the world because people love what we're producing. We got to keep up that high quality level. We got to keep talking about how low our environmental footprint is. I mean, it's not an accident that we have the highest quality beef on planet Earth with the lowest environmental footprint. But we also need to make sure that our producers are getting paid for what they produce. And that's been the big challenge right over the last couple of years. That herd contraction, while never ideal, is gonna force that issue. We've seen it in the markets the last few weeks, right? Packers are short bought. They're scrambling for cattle. That's driving those prices higher. That is positive. That's the cattle cycle doing what it does and putting that leverage pendulum a little bit back in the producer's favor. So we're going to watch those dynamics over the next year or two. We keep getting these headwinds, right? Whether it's hacking at a plant, whether it's labor shortages. I'm waiting for a satellite to fall out of the sky, right, and crash into a packing facility.
Don't say that.
Right, I got to knock on wood. But, I mean, that's really what it's felt like the last couple of years. It's like this industry can't catch a break on just getting cattle pushed through the pipeline, right? We got this fantastic supply of market-ready cattle. Producers are doing their job. They're doing it better than anyone's ever done it in the history of the world. We got to get them processed, and we got to get them out to store shelves. So that's really going to be the focus over the next year or two. I don't think anybody that's watching this market closely is going to be breathing easy just because there's so much at play. There are so many moving pieces. There are so many vulnerabilities out there that we've stress tested over the last 2 years and identified that we're working on. That's going to continue to be the case, but it sure looks like it's moving in a better direction.
Any closing thoughts or anything else that you think people should know about? And also, before we do that, you mentioned Houston. I'm excited about Houston coming up. Tell us about that.
You know, we're going to be down in the great state of Texas for our convention in Houston. We're expecting a big crowd. We had a great crowd in Nashville for our rescheduled convention in August. This is going to be a great opportunity to really get into some of these issues at a pivotal time in the industry. I mean, trade, cattle markets, sustainability, I mean, what we're doing on those issues is, you know, just on another level than what we've seen in the past out of this industry. Producers are excited about it. This is a great opportunity to come together and really talk through where we go from here. So we'll see everybody in Houston at the beginning of February. Hopefully we're going to be there with 9 or 10,000 of our closest friends for a couple days. We're expecting some big ticket speakers to show up for that event. We've invited the Secretary of Agriculture. We're going to have, I think, an ambassador or two there. We're going to have a good suite of people. We're hoping to kind of get more and more back to normal. I mean, producers want to meet. They want to get together. They want to have that hallway conversation. This is a great opportunity to do it. So we'll see everybody in Houston in a few months.
All right. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. D-Sol, formulated by AgroPlanté, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. D-Sol will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlanté's D-Sol flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With D-Sol, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlanté today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplanté.com. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Okay, well, let's start out with your names, your titles, and where you're from, please.
I'm Doug Jones. I'm the EPA Region 7 Agriculture Advisor.
My name is Edward Chu. I'm the Deputy Regional Administrator in EPA Region 7.
All right, so now what area does Region 7 cover?
Region 7 covers four states, Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, and Missouri.
And we are talking today in Missouri because we are at the NAFB Trade Talk, which is held in Kansas City, Missouri, and that's why you guys are here. And you're with the EPA, and of course, EPA and farming, we talk about it all over the nation. I'm from California, but I thought that we could discuss some topics together and just open a conversation between EPA and agriculture. From your perspective, and let's start with Doug, from your perspective, how is that relationship between EPA and agriculture, and what can we do with it?
Well, as an agriculture advisor, my primary role is to advance that relationship. Administrator Regan has been very clear that agriculture is going to have a seat at the table in this administration to help inform our decision-making moving forward. And, you know, there's nowhere that agriculture is more important than Region 7. I mean, with some 80 million acres in our region alone devoted to some type of agriculture, it's clear how important it is to our citizens. So we want to engage with farmers and ranchers and have those conversations, make sure that we understand the positions of Region 7 stakeholders so that we can inform not only our regional leadership about, you know, how things are going and what people think, but also national leadership as well.
And what would you add to that, Edward?
Yeah, you know, at EPA, we are really about finding solutions that really work for our agricultural communities and also finding points of common interest. And all we know that agricultural communities are also very much aligned with protecting air, land, and water. And we also always talk about the fact that farmers have been the first conservationists in this country. And so we have a common set of goals. And so what we want to do at EPA is to sit at the table, as Doug just mentioned, and both the president and Administrator Regan has said that we need to sit at the table together to address difficult issues together. Now when you sit at a dinner table, as all of us know, well, we're going to have difficult conversations. We're not always going to agree, but we want to find solutions that are durable so that at the end of the day, when we leave the dinner table, that we can all walk away feeling like that we have found a set of solutions that helps the agricultural sector in this country.
For in California, where I typically broadcast, and we have our own issues, and each region, I'm sure, deals with different things. What are some of the things that you guys deal with in Region 7?
Well, I can prop up one example just to give you an example of partnerships and how we work with the agriculture stakeholders in the region. In Kansas and parts of Oklahoma, there exists an ecoregion called the Kansas Flint Hills, and it's a tallgrass prairie ecosystem, and it's the last contiguous remaining expanse of tallgrass prairie in the country. And fire, prescribed fire, is used to maintain that ecosystem to keep invasive species like red cedar out and to maintain the integrity of that tallgrass system and also the viability of the ranching community. Now, one of the challenges with that is the smoke from those fires may impact downwind communities. And so as an air quality agency, I mean, that's one of our primary roles. We have to do our best to navigate that. And the only way that we can do that is if all of the stakeholders are at the table and talking about these things and figuring out ways to get through that together. I've been very encouraged in recent years by the number of different organizations and groups that have come to the table from health departments to conservation groups to the farming and ranching community to state, federal agencies. Everybody comes together before the burn season to talk about weather patterns and the things that we can do to minimize the impact of that smoke on downwind communities. So that's just one example of partnerships with the ag community and how we can advance our goals together.
And that's one that's really going to ring true back to my listeners in California, because obviously we deal with so many fire issues. Many think that prescribed fires in several areas would be a big benefit, but then also we have so many smoke issues just from our wildfires alone. So that is a topic. You picked an excellent topic that will definitely ring true to my growers back home in California. Would you add anything to that?
The only thing that I'll add is that one of the other issues that we see around the country is dealing with water quality issues. And one other kind of collaborative effort partnership that we have with our agricultural community here is to deal with some of the downstream issues in the Gulf. We have a hypoxia task force that we are part of, and our states are participants in that. It's, again, trying to figure out how we can have smart agriculture upstream so that we can help communities downstream. And these are not regulatory programs. We're working with our farmers, and we're working with state agriculture departments. From EPA perspective, there are counterparts. We also work with USDA to find common solutions. And, you know, I want to just have a call out to our Iowa's nutrient reduction strategy. Iowa's, as you know, is a big agriculture state, just like California. And so these are how we work on this is really, again, having people at the table, having common goals, and finding environmental stewardship as a common goal together, and finding solutions to address them.
I'm going to ask you kind of a more personal question, if you don't mind, but your role is very important, both of you, and I want to know, how does this, what are some of the qualities that you take into your role, and why is it important to you?
Well, I think one of the things that you have to remember whenever we have these discussions is that we're all part of the community as well. And particularly here in Lenexa, Kansas, we're just over the border from Missouri. You mentioned to your listeners that you're in Missouri. And most of our staff are from here. And, you know, we're a very agricultural community, so we all have connections to agriculture because that is a primary sector in our economy here. And so I think the understanding of how agriculture and the large role that it plays and the job that we need to do collectively, right, not just EPA, but USDA and other agencies, as well as the farmers and growers and all the sectors that are also supporting agriculture, that, you know, because it's not just farmers, right? And it's all the industry that, and for us to be aware of that, I think is extremely important. And also knowing that the farmers also, we always talk about the fact that understanding that we're part of the community also. So we have common goals in terms of protecting air, land, and water. So the question is, how do we work together to make sure that we achieve that the same goal that we have?
And Doug, would you add anything to that?
I guess the only thing that I would add is that there are a network of ag advisors across the country. So for your listeners in California, there's an agriculture advisor in that region as well as headquarters. Rod Snyder was recently appointed by Administrator Regan, so we're happy to have Rod on board. And you know, I would just encourage folks to use that network to pass along information or concerns. You know, it'd be very difficult for me to do my job as an ag advisor if I didn't hear from folks in the community. So use me as a resource, use that network. Feel free to reach out if you have any concerns. You know, we hate for someone to hear about something that EPA is doing, but if something as simple as a phone call can alleviate concerns, you know, that's what we'd like to do. So I would just encourage people to talk to us.
Any closing thoughts from either of you?
Well, the only other thing that I would add is that, you know, I think we all need to look to the future. And one of the things that that I want to mention is that the president and the administration has really put tackling climate crisis as one of the very important environmental issues that we need to tackle. And I believe, and those of us here in Region 7 believe, that agriculture sector has a large role to play, being smart about how we farm and how we conserve. And I think this is a conversation that I think everybody around the country, not just here in Region 7, ought to undertake in their communities.
Any closing thoughts, Doug?
I don't think so. I mean, I think Ed covered it very well. I mean, clearly farmers are interested in engaging in climate solutions with climate smart agriculture practices. I mean, I think that begins with soil health, and we'd certainly like to have those conversations moving forward to ensure that growers can take advantage of some of these types of solutions.
Thank you both for your time, and thank you for being here. I appreciate it. That's our show for today. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.